The gunmetal bulk of the drone called Jace appeared at the far end of the terrace, out of the lodge itself. Fowl smiled when she saw it and sat down on a stone bench jutting out from the low wall which separated terrace from view. They were high up, but it was a hot and windless day. She wiped a little sweat from her forehead as the old drone floated along the terrace toward her, the slanting lines of sunlight passing over its body in a steady rhythm. The drone settled on the stones beside the bench, its broad, flat top about level with the crown of the girl's head.
"Isn't it a lovely day, Jace?" Fal said, looking back at the distant mountains again.
"It is," Jace said.
The drone had an unusually deep and full-toned voice and made the most of it. For 1,000 years or more, culture drones had had aura fields which coloured according to their mood, their equivalent of facial expression and body language. But Jace was old, made long before aura fields were thought of, and had refused to be refitted to accommodate them. It preferred either to rely on its voice to express what it felt, or to remain inscrutable.
"Damn."
Fowl shook her head, looking at the faraway snow.
"I wish I was climbing."
She made a clicking noise with her mouth and looked down at her right leg, which stuck straight out in front of her. She had broken the leg 8 days before while climbing in the mountains on the other side of the plain. Now it was splinted up with a fine tracery of field strands concealed beneath fashionably tight trousers. Jace ought, she thought, to have taken this as an excuse to lecture her again on the advisability of only climbing with a floater harness or with a rescue drone nearby, or at the very least on not climbing alone. But the old machine said nothing. She looked at it, her tanned face shining in the light.
"So, Jace, what have you got for me? Business?"
"I'm afraid so."
Fal settled herself as comfortably as she could on the stone bench and crossed her arms. Jace stretched out a short force field from its casing to support the awkward-looking outstretched leg, though it knew that the splint's own fields were taking all the strain.
"Spit it out," Fal said.
"You may recall an item from the Daily Synopsis 18 days ago about one of our spacecraft, which was cobbled together by a factory vessel in the volume of space inside from the Sullen Gulf. The factory craft had to destruct, and later so did the ship it made."
"I remember," said Fowl, who forgot little about anything and nothing at all from a Daily Synopsis. "It was a mongrel, because the factory was just trying to get a GSV mined out of the way."
"Well," Jace said, its voice a little weary, "we have a problem with that."
Fal smiled. The culture, there could be no doubt, relied profoundly on its machines for both its strategy and tactics in the war it was now engaged in. Indeed, a case could be made for holding that the culture was its machines, that they represented it at a more fundamental level than did any single human or group of humans within the society. The minds that the culture's factory craft, safe orbitals and larger GSVs were now producing were some of the most sophisticated collections of matter in the galaxy. They were so intelligent that no human was capable of understanding just how smart they were, and the machines themselves were incapable of describing it to such a limited form of life. From those mental colossi, down through the more ordinary but still sentient machines and the smart but ultimately mechanistic and predictable computers, right down to the smallest circuit in a micro-missile hardly more intelligent than a fly, the culture had placed its bets, long before the Adiran War had been envisaged, on the machine rather than the human brain. This was because the culture saw itself as being a self-consciously rational society, and machines, even sentient ones, were more capable of achieving this desired state as well as more efficient at using it once they had. That was good enough for the culture. Besides, it left the humans in the culture free to take care of the things that really mattered in life, such as sports, games, romance, studying dead languages, barbarian societies, and impossible problems and climbing high mountains without the aid of a safety harness. A hostile reading of such a situation might lead to the idea that the discovery by the culture's minds that some humans were actually capable of matching and occasionally beating their record for accurately assessing a given set of facts would lead to a machine in indignation and blown circuits. But this was not the case. It fascinated those minds that such a puny and chaotic collection of mental faculties could, by some sleight of neuron, produce an answer to a problem which was as good as theirs.
There was an explanation, of course, and it perhaps had something to do with patterns of cause and effect, which even the most godlike power of the minds had difficulty trying to fathom. It also had quite a lot to do with sheer weight of numbers. There were in excess of 18 trillion people in the culture, just about every one of them well-nourished, extensively educated and mentally alert, and only 30 or 40 of them had this unusual ability to forecast and assess on a par with a well-informed mind, of which there were already many hundreds of thousands. It was not impossible that this was pure luck. Toss 18 trillion coins in the air for a while, and a few of them are going to keep landing the same side up for a long, long time.